Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let's talk about this week's show. We're going to do a deep dive into the evidence, which is pretty darn convincing, that there is a substantial brain microbiome connection with mental illness. We're also going to cover a lot of listener questions about chronic infections and chronic inflammation. And we're going to talk a little bit about why some of the one-size-fits-all recommendations you've been hearing from your doctors for years, unless, of course, it's me, why these are probably wrong. Let's start with a wonderful article that I just recently read. And this is about a researcher named Ted Dynan. He's a psychiatrist, and he is a principal investigator. And I'm going to have to say this in British because I just have to, at the Elementary Pharmabiotic Center at University College Cork. Now, I can't do an Irish accent. Sorry about that, but doing my best here. This is a institute entirely focused on nutrition and the microbiome. And he's been doing this kind of research for more than 30 years. So we're going to talk about psychobiotics. You've heard of probiotics, you've heard of prebiotics, but have you heard about psychobiotics? Well, the first thing that you need to know is that there are five major human neurotransmitters: GABA, which is a calming agent. In fact, Valium and its cousins fit into the GABA receptors. Serotonin, and we all know about that because Prozac and its cousins work to keep serotonin sitting there in the synapse for a little bit longer as a treatment for depression. Norepinephrine, also used as a treatment for depression. Dopamine, which is where you get your reward cycles. It's very important in learning, particularly that sense of satisfaction that you get when you actually succeed pretty much at anything. And the last but not least, acetylcholine, which as far as the brain is concerned, is the neurochemical of memory. And it's also very important in the control of the parasympathetic response. That's the rest and digest. And it's a major neurotransmitter in the vagus nerve, about which we shall be speaking more. So all of these neurotransmitters are actually produced by your gut flora. For example, all strains of lactobacillus, you find that in yogurt, you find that in a lot of things. All of these produce GABA, some produce more than others, but they're all capable of calming you down. It's fair to say that most of the neurotransmitters up until this point, we've understood them as acting locally. So they work in the gut to calm down the gut, but it seems like there's also a signal going back up the vagus nerve from the enteric nervous system. You've got a very big brain in your intestine. Dr. Dynan profiled 12 strains of lactobacilli and bifidobacterium, and he used animal models. And he was trying to establish whether or not these bugs impacted cognition and behavior. These were mouse studies, let me clarify that. They had a bunch of bacteria, I said 12 different strains. They found that there were three lactobacillus species, and I won't bore you with the details there, that of the 12, all reduced stress-related behaviors in stressed animals, and they reduced behaviors that were suggestive of anxiety and depression. One of them, called LPC-37, actually drastically reduced the circulating levels of cortisol in the bloodstream of the stressed mice. Of course, chronic stress causes elevated cortisol until your adrenal gland loses the ability to produce these extraordinarily high levels. And then you get a phenomenon, sort of the equivalent of what happens when your pancreas runs out of ability to continue to double the amount of insulin in your system. You crash. A different strain in his work also significantly increased the number of GABA receptors. So you got increased GABA neurotransmission. They used bifidobacterium later on in a human study, and they found a strain that reduced morning salivary cortisol. In other words, you spit into a little tube, they measure your cortisol, they put you on this probiotic versus placebo, and your cortisol levels go down. You also, not knowing that you're getting the active compound, reported less subjective stress. Okay, so yeah, what could be placebo, could be coincidence. Here's the thing. They also studied the group with EEG. So the people taking the psychobiotic and the control people were looked for on EEG measurements. I won't go into the weeds here, but essentially there's a pattern to stress in your brain. Certain parts are more active and it's a different pattern. And this changed in the group fed this particular form of Bifidobacterium longan. And so then they did a study on university students over two semesters. And then they either took a placebo or the probiotic for the first semester, and the second semester they switched. They measured sleep duration using accelerometers, and the students who got the psychobiotics had better sleep. And, you know, college students, sleep is important for learning. Now, anybody who has irritable bowel syndrome can tell you that stress and anxiety can trigger or exacerbate the symptoms. And we know that there are more than 1,000 different species of microorganisms in every human gut, and they produce some really substantial, important things, including compounds that calm down the gut and reduce the irritable bowel. They've also looked at the growth of neurons in animals, and they found that myelination in the prefrontal cortex is different in a developing animal that does not have a healthy microbiome. Could this be? And I mean, this is an extrapolation. I'm not saying it's true, but could this be the reason that in the aftermath of introducing antibiotics, not only into every child's gut early for trivial things like ear infections, but also in the food supply by putting it in animal feed, have we possibly changed development in a generation of humans leading to impaired function in susceptible individuals in the prefrontal cortex, which is what keeps you from having ADD? You'll remember when you take Ritalin or any of the other drugs like Adderall, you're actually stimulating the prefrontal cortex. And by stimulating the calm down part of the brain, you calm down. They also did research on the hippocampus. These are where you produce neurons for memory. And this was a study done in germ-free animals. So these were experimental animals that were raised with essentially no germs in their environment, sterile lab, born of sterile mothers, so they have no gut microbiota. They're missing all of those compounds that ordinarily would be produced and would control, apparently, neurological differentiation. In these groups, they saw differences in neurogenesis. They also saw a difference in the connections, the dendrites between the nerves, and they saw differences in behavior. The mice from the low bacteria or sterile labs did not behave like normal mice. They were confused and did not have any of the emergent social behavior that you would ordinarily see. Oh, wait, we have a generation who don't seem to have the normal emergent social behavior. Could there be a connection? No, certainly the internet and social media are playing a role here, but there's room for more factors causing this shift. So there's basically three things, according to Dr. Dinan, that are important. One of them is the vagus nerve. One of them is a bacterial, let's call it byproduct of their own metabolism called short chain fatty acids. You might have heard of butyrate. Butter has high levels of butyrate, and butter-laden coffee has been all the rage the last few years. Well, butyrate actually is extremely important in behavior. I'll come to that in a moment. There are also something else you need to know, which is tryptophan. Tryptophan is the precursor for serotonin. Remember we talked about serotonin and depression? Well, if you don't have the right flora, you don't produce a normal amount of tryptophan. This tryptophan actually gets into the brain from the gut, but is primarily not in the diet. It's produced by the correct flora, which if you don't have, well, maybe you've got a problem. Now, there's a fascinating study from Scandinavia looking at people who had had vagotomies in the 60s or 70s. Back in the day, before we understood that ulcers were caused by bacteria, people with chronic recurrent ulcers, which is when they bleed, a life-threatening condition, were treated by a vagotomy, cutting the vagus nerve, so that the stimulation for acid production in the stomach could not arrive at the stomach. Now, this had undoubtedly some effects on their digestion. But people who had vagotomies had a far lower incidence of Parkinson's disease as they aged, compared to age-matched people with intact vagus nerves. Now, we've talked about alpha-synuclein before. This is a protein that accumulates in the substantia nigra of people with Parkinson's disease. But what many people may not remember is that this first shows up in the gut. It is produced by a bad bacteria. And if you have a damaged vagus nerve, that alpha-synuclein can't get to the brain. So this provides indirect evidence that it's climbing up the vagus nerve. And remember, nerves are basically pipes. They're hollow cells. They're like a very, very long pseudopod. And if you can get inside the pipe, there's no reason that you couldn't travel in the opposite direction up to the spinal column. And from there, you might even be able to climb up the rest of the spinal column into the brain, or perhaps it gets released from there into this central nervous system fluid, the CSF, in which case it'll just float up to the brain and somehow end up in the substantia nigra. A recent study, and it's a small study, but it's really interesting on these lines, was fecal transplant in Parkinson's patients. And this study showed that their Parkinson's disease improved when they received fecal transplants from healthy individuals. This raises some very interesting ideas. Now, I mentioned short-chain fatty acids earlier, and these are super important. And when I do evaluation for people with gut problems, I look very carefully to see what short-chain fatty acids they're producing. And this is a byproduct of bacterial eating the fiber. So if you have a low-fiber diet, you tend to be low. If you have a high-fiber diet and the right bacteria, you tend to be high, particularly of butyrate. Now, the short-chain fatty acids can travel directly to the brain. They get into the bloodstream. They cross the blood-brain barrier. And they interact with receptors on the brain, and they regulate genetic activity. This is established. Butyrate, for example, which is the strongest of them, is an inhibitor of histone deacetylase. So this, among other things, may make it a potent anti-cancer agent. And it also is helpful in, how should I put this, buffering overreactivity to an environmental toxin or stimulus. These short-chain fatty acids also upregulate enzymes in the gut that turn tryptophan into serotonin, and they downregulate the bacteria that wastes the tryptophan. Most of the tryptophan, as I said, is made by the gut flora. So the microbiome is just so important. So there've been some mental illness studies. I told you I was going to get to that. We've covered the anxiety connection. But this was a study in humans looking at severely depressed patients versus age and sex matched control subjects. Overall, the depressed people had less diverse and less rich microbiota. They were missing the things that make the tryptophan. And what's really interesting is that they took poo from the depressed humans, transplanted it into rats, and got depressed rat behavior. Whereas when they used poo from normal, non-depressed humans, the control group, the rat's behavior did not change. This work is interesting. But what about other measurements? Because, I mean, depression is very hard to test. Well, this study done in 2018 in Austria looked at MRI, functional MRI, to document how the microbiome changes the human brain. Both papers were based on data from about 45 healthy subjects between 20 and 40, and they went into three groups. One got a multi-strain probiotic for 4 weeks. The second got a placebo, and the third got nothing. So the probiotic, I'm not going to go into details about, but what they did was they tracked MRI changes while the subjects did emotional decision-making and emotional recognition memory tests. And there were major differences between the probiotic-treated group and the controls. So you've wiped out the placebo effect. Essentially, what they saw was increased positive mood and a blunting of vulnerability to that feeling of hopelessness and deer-in-the-headlights risk aversion that goes with depression. I won't go into all of the anatomy. You're welcome. But in a second study, they looked at brain networks and found that brain connectivity and function was drastically altered in the treatment group, although there was no structural changes that could be seen. They could see activity changes, kind of like looking at activity on a network to see how many people are plugged in to a particular website. There's also some research coming out of China. This was a what we call a mega trial. It was a systemic review or a meta-analysis, but it took the number up to 1,146 subjects, and they took different types of probiotics, but they saw a significant difference, not just statistically significant, but also just an actual improvement in the group. And there's another study from Auckland, New Zealand, that looked at 423 women who were started on either lactobacillus rhamnosus during their pregnancy, during the second trimester. And they took those treatments through their pregnancy and until 6 months postpartum. And the women in the probiotic group had much, much lower rates of postnatal depression, which is a serious problem affecting about 20% of women after their pregnancy. It's probably related to these drastic hormone fluctuations which occur. Now, there's a lot to unpack here, but the bottom line is that a healthy diet can improve your mood, it can improve depression, it can protect you from all sorts of diseases, and one of the fundamentals here is getting adequate fiber. So I want to take a moment and just emphasize those fruits and vegetables. When we say get a lot of color in your diet, we're not really talking about FDA red dye number 4, okay? We are talking about things that come off of the planet having been grown by plants that are red. Those contain many types of compounds, proanthocyanins, lutein, some carotenoids. I mean, there are just a huge number of super beneficial compounds that are in actual real food that grows on the planet. So if you're having problems with depression or mood swings or irritable bowel, you need to shift your diet. You need to get yourself checked for some of the adverse flora. The ones, when we talk about low variability or low diversity, we're generally seeing an overgrowth, a monocropping phenomenon from one of the more aggressive bugs. These may not be pathogens, but some of them are, like Klebsiella and Pseudomonas, which can both cause pneumonia. But they are bugs that should be there in small amounts that are there in large amounts. And they crowd out the good guys. The good guys can't get a root. And if you have that situation, you need to get rid of the bad guys. You need to take probiotics in fairly high quantities, which you can do by simply making sauerkraut. And cabbage is cheap, so don't tell me you can't afford probiotics. Look up the recipe online and make yourself some sauerkraut. Yogurt's not that expensive either, and both of these contain both some probiotics, but more importantly, they contain food that the good bacteria like. There's a product called inulin, which if you do nothing else, Jerusalem artichokes, otherwise known as sunchokes, have very high levels of inulin, and you can persuade that bifidobacterium. Remember we talked about bifidobacterium? You can raise your numbers of bifidobacterium simply by doing that. I've got a few minutes before the break, so I'm going to take the first of our emails, and this one comes from Tim in Santa Cruz. Tim writes, Dental Health, General Health. Dear doctor, awesome show. Love how you and the computer man always bring the energy as well as the knowledge. Hadn't been to see a dentist for 15 years until receding gums forced my hand. Ah, Tim, you're one of those healthy guys. After way too many x-rays, in my opinion, I am scheduled for 4 separate sessions of deep cleaning. My concern is that for people with sketchy immune systems, bacteria from these procedures can get into the bloodstream and in some cases causes root planing that can cause receding gums. Oi, what to do? I'm 70 and have gut says dysbiosis, Canada, and lymphocytic colitis. Any comments most welcome? Well, Tim, we're going to start off with lymphocytic colitis, because what that means is that the layer of your colon directly under the cells that are doing the absorbing is infiltrated with lymphocytes, which does not happen in an ordinary colon. And it probably means that bits of broken down bad bacteria are actually leaking across the skin of the lining and in causing a false alarm, basically. Oh, look, there's a piece of broken bacteria. The immune system can't tell the difference between dead bacteria and live bacteria, so it mounts a full-on attack. And you may even have some live bacteria leaking through, especially if you're a regular user of either proton pump inhibitors or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen. So it's a sort of series of wrong decisions. You take the medications that interfere with the gut flora, you don't eat a diet high in fiber, you consume a lot of alcohol, which can also trigger this because alcohol is a solvent for the mucus that is really your first layer of protection, just like in your nose. So now what you've got is an inflammatory loop going. And the fact that you found Candida, you probably have other things growing too. So you have a dysbiosis that needs to be addressed. And there's plenty of information on how to go about addressing that on previous programs. And let's talk about inflammation in general, since it's germane to what we've been talking about. Inflammation is bad. You want to get those pockets cleaned out because that inflammation in your mouth, that's very close to your brain. And you may be building beta amyloid in your brain, regardless of your DNA, if you have bad teeth. And there is ample data on this, much of it coming out of the United Kingdom, where you see increased rates of Alzheimer's. And this occurs even in people without a family history if they have really bad teeth. So you need to get your mouth cleaned up. I'd recommend getting a water pick and cleaning out those. There's a little device you can use that'll get down into the pockets and, you know, let them clean them out, but you keep them clean. It's going to take a while for those gums to grow back and you're going to need to floss. As far as, you know, oral probiotics, they exist. I haven't really seen data that tell me exactly how well they work, but you've got to get that cleaned out. That's really that. And you've got to fix your microbiome. Now, if you want to, I can guide you. You can come and see me at my office and we'll go through a microbiome reboot and, you know, go to AskDrDawn.com and click on the practice link and you can come in. But most importantly, these are problems that need to be addressed right away. It is a big deal. And it's like termites in your house, right? It's like dry rot in your stairway leading down to your garage. It definitely has an adverse effect on your existence. Before I launch back into our next email, I also want to let you know that when you go to our Santa Cruz County Public Health website, it can be a little hard to find the link to where the vaccinations are. And so if you're having trouble and getting frustrated, and not everyone has trouble, but I've heard enough to know that some do, you can just go to AskDrDawn.com in the resource page. Let me say that again. You can go to AskDrDawn.com, and then on the left, you'll see resources, and go to the resources, and there you will find your link. And if you scroll down to where that link takes you, it will take you to the announcements of who's got vaccine and how to get an appointment, including the pharmacies, which at the moment are your best bet. Anything else I want to say about that? With respect to the variants, whenever a virus divides, it's like a coin flip. And there, it's more like Xeroxing a document over and over and over again. You can get degradation and the DNA can change. Excuse me, the RNA can change. And in that situation, you've got a variant. Most of those variants don't do anything. There are literally thousands of variants which have been identified, but they aren't in the right place to change anything that we care about, which is to say the structure of the spike protein. However, nothing has happened that has caused it to change that much. And I want to emphasize that you make enough antibodies to neutralize any of the variants by two or three orders of magnitude after these vaccinations. So do not worry that you are not going to derive a benefit because the darn thing's going to mutate out from under the vaccine. What will happen is that people will, instead of having a 95% chance of having undetectable COVID, they might have a 90 or a 85% chance, and they might get a light case instead of the vaccine, which honestly is what happens with flu vaccine anyway. Many people who take the flu vaccine don't notice the flu, which is exactly what we want. They got it, but they didn't notice it because the vaccine kept them safe. So let's keep that as our framework here, because that's the accurate one. Okay, now we're going to Richard in Redwood City. Bacteria replacement for rheumatoid arthritis is Richard's question. Hi, Dr. Don. Appreciate your interesting shows and science-based information. I've been following the overall trend, I hope, of one, understanding that several health issues are caused by so-called bad bacteria taking up residence in the human microbiome. Two, searching for good bacteria that will occupy that same niche in the biome and evict the bad bacteria. Are you aware of any studies, progress, trials of this approach for rheumatoid arthritis? Considering the number of people suffering with this disease, it seems like a worthwhile investment of research. I'm also trying to help a 45-year-old female cousin who has had rheumatoid arthritis for 5 to 7 years. Can you also mention any other recent advancements in the treatment for RA? Well, let me talk about Proteus mirabilis. Doesn't that sound, you know, Proteus, it can change its shape. Mirabilis, it's miraculous. Well, actually, no, it's pathogen, gives you a bladder infection. But it's also standard gut flora. And what we see in people with rheumatoid arthritis, and I'm giving you information that goes back 20, maybe 30 years. If you take people with rheumatoid arthritis and you give them a long, fairly long weeks and weeks course of erythromycin, a very common ancient now antibiotic related to Zithromax, which most of you have heard of, you get an improvement, a mitigation of their symptoms or prevention of flare-ups. Now, that's interesting. When I learned that, the postulation in the discussion was, well, maybe erythromycin has an anti-inflammatory effect. In other words, it wasn't because it was killing bacteria. It was because it was, you know, affecting inflammation receptors. Well, no, it was because it was killing bacteria. And bugs like Proteus are often extremely susceptible to the macrolide category of antibiotics, which trashes their ribosomes and therefore prevents them from reproducing any protein. And that is a pretty drastic kill. Proteus and rheumatoid arthritis. Well, what about other bacteria? Well, yes, indeed. Many of the dysbiotic bacteria are associated in epidemiological studies where you look at people with the disease and without the disease and then look at their poo. All those dysbiotic bacteria are pro-inflammatory and they have an effect on the immune system. So just like I was saying to Tim, I would try to get your friend, cousin, to go to a functional medicine doctor for a gut reboot. Other things that are extremely helpful and safe are things like curcumin, which is an anti-inflammatory, Boswellia, another anti-inflammatory, uña de gato or cat's claw, and all of these things lower NF-kappa B. And if you've been in the weeds on COVID, you've heard of that. That is the first step in the inflammatory surge. And if you can lower or prevent NF-kappa B from getting to the nucleus of your cells, you don't activate, among other things, the COX-1 and the COX-2 that create the inflammatory prostaglandins. So you're going way upstream and essentially putting out the fire before it gets rolling, which is exactly what you want to do in these things. So the microbiome is one of the levers I use. These agents I've mentioned are another lever that I recommend. And the third is vitamin D. Rheumatoid arthritis is, after all, an autoimmune inflammatory disease. So what you want to do there? You want to calm down the T cells, which are what are active in rheumatoid arthritis, creating the inflammation. You know what'll do that? High levels of vitamin D. What do I mean by high levels? Well, I mean you have to monitor your blood levels, and you want your blood levels between 70 and 90. And that is more than twice the quote-unquote safe range that, by the way, used to be two-thirds of that until they realized that our safe range was not safe and booted it up a bit. But, you know, medicine, big medicine, doesn't like to admit it's wrong. And yeah, well, if we're going to be science-based, let me just tell you that the most conservative entity, the American Academy of Medicine, says you can take 6,000 units of vitamin D3 every day for a long period, like years, without harm. So if you're nervous, try that. It'll take maybe a year or two to get up to the 70 or 90 range, but that's okay. I actually prefer to go slow so that the body has a chance to adapt. I don't like to throw curveballs, particularly with things that act as hormones on the immune system. We're going on to our next email, and this from Brad in SoCal. COVID-19 mRNA vaccines. Dear Dr. Don, if my understanding is correct, mRNA vaccines train the immune system to attack anything that matches the spike protein contained in the vaccine. That is correct, Brad. That is also what the other vaccines are doing, by the way, including the viral vectors. It would seem that some of the risks of this approach would be that some component in the vaccine causes a side effect, that the vaccine is not effective, i.e., the vaccine is not recognized by the immune system, and or three, the vaccine trains the immune system to attack something that is not good and that should not be removed. In doing so, the immune system might damage good cells or organs in the body. So I'm going to start with that third one because it really relates to the question about rheumatoid arthritis as well. The reason that the mirabilis, the Proteus mirabilis, causes a flare is because the immune system is having a case of mistaken identity. It's ramping up its defenses against the Proteus, but the recognition is getting confused. The joints in people with rheumatoid arthritis, which is one of the reasons why it's often hereditary, the lining of their joints looks like Proteus. So when you boot up the Proteus levels, the immune system ramps up its attack on Proteus and ends up attacking the innocent bystander, the joints, and setting off that NF-kappa B, and we're off to the races. That could happen, but it doesn't, because the spike protein is drastically different from anything that our bodies produce on the surface. We've pretty much got all the molecules cataloged at this point that are on the cell surfaces. That's been a very big deal because of organ transplant tissue matching. And we're looking at, oh, I don't know, probably 40 or 50 years that's been a thing. And so, yeah, we don't have to really worry about that. Door number two, though, the vaccine is not effective. The vaccine is not recognized by the immune system. Well, the vaccine is not what is being recognized. It's the mRNA inside of the nanoparticle. The two vaccines that we're talking about for this conversation are the Pfizer and the Moderna. And in that situation, it's recognized all right. We've got excellent data that you get a titer on spike protein. These are not people who got infected with COVID, because you can tell because of those changes that I mentioned that don't do anything. Well, if you get COVID, you're going to make antibodies to other things beside the spike protein. And those can be tracked as well, those other things on the surface or other entities that are part of the virus. If we look for them, we'll find antibodies to those as well in people who had COVID.
And so we can say that, oh, this is a variant from the wild, from the original COVID, but it doesn't matter. The vaccines still work just as well. And I think we're seeing that for the most part with these latest variants. And so I want to emphasize that. Number one, yeah, let's talk about some component of the vaccine causes a side effect. Well, I think that's true. It's the components that were inserted into the vaccine to ensure a strong immune response. I think you're going to have to think of this as selective pressure, okay? We want to see a strong immune response. And in fact, you aren't going to get to sell your vaccine unless you show a strong immune response. You have to show that strong immune response, and you also have to show that people don't get sick, so you know those antibodies work, or that their level of disease is reduced, or, and particularly what we care about, is bad long COVID and bad kills you COVID. A light case of COVID, which many people have, is for the most part survivable and doesn't leave a trace except for your immunity. Now, there are people who get sicker and who have it for a long time. And I've seen several of those people, and I'll tell you, they pretty much all have bad gut flora so far. Now, I have confirmation bias, it's true, but I actually think a healthy microbiome doesn't necessarily protect you from COVID, but I do think that it protects you from long COVID, as well as maybe high levels of vitamin D, which modulate your immune system. And, you know, we'll see. But if there's people who think they have long COVID out there, please reach out to me. Go to AskDrDawn.com and click the Contact Us button, because I have, I think, something that might help and won't hurt. And I need to gather data on this idea. So please reach out if you are in that circumstance. I think we all need to try this idea out. But without cases, I'm not going to get anywhere. I don't have an academic degree, and I don't have research funding. And maybe I'm crazy. Could be. So I need data to prove it's not my own confirmation bias. We've got time now to go to John in Aptos. Hyperthyroidism and Graves' disease. Hi, Dr. Dawn. I recently read where reactivation of the Epstein-Barr virus into various stages is responsible for thyroid disease. The virus remains dormant in the body until certain triggers weaken the immune response or provide it with fuel to strengthen itself and attack the thyroid. Have you heard of this idea, and what is your take? Well, Epstein-Barr virus, our old friend, the yuppie flu, right? Chronic fatigue, yuppie flu, high levels of Epstein-Barr virus titer. So it must be a reactivation. Well, my friends, it ain't necessarily so. In fact, I really doubt it. I think that what's going on with Epstein-Barr virus as well, because if you look under a few other rocks, you'll see that I'm proved right. People who have chronic fatigue, which is a garbage bag diagnosis and includes several different groups with drastically different problems that need to be sorted out. But people who have the, let's call it the inflammatory version of chronic fatigue, have an overactivated immune system that doesn't stop itself. It's in a loop, like a washing machine that just keeps on spinning. And you keep on making antibodies and releasing compounds that cause you to make more antibodies. And so those cells that have been sitting there, not the EBV, that's not dormant, but the cells that you taught to make antibodies against Epstein-Barr virus, which have been happily sitting there, a few of them circulating around in your bloodstream, not making any antibodies, just checking out the scenery, sees any EBV, it'll start making antibodies. Oh, wait. Now it's super stimulated and it makes antibodies anyway. So you typically will see a bump across the board. And it's kind of interesting because not only will you see cytomegalovirus and EBV, you may see increase in herpes virus antibodies, particularly the oral herpes. You'll often see autoantibodies. So things like anti-nuclear antibody and things like Sjogren's antibody, things like anti-TPO, which is the antibody that causes Hashimoto's disease. So it wouldn't be a surprise to me that in this circumstance, you would have an increased level of EBV because of the chronic inflammatory response syndrome, and an increase in the autoantibody production of the thing that attacks the thyroid and stimulates it. In Graves' disease, you've basically got an antibody that looks like thyroid stimulating hormone and fools the receptor into being activated as if the brain was sending the signal. Well, the antibody is a molecular mimic of the signal. This is a really different autoimmune disease in terms of how it works, but it's almost a proof of concept when it shows that this molecular memory mistaken identity hypothesis, you know, it really is a thing. So I see this particular correlation that you read about as a misinterpretation. It's not cause and effect. They're both effects, and the cause is the chronic inflammatory response syndrome, which is also exactly what is going on with long COVID. I'm getting very fond of treating chronic inflammatory response syndrome in all of its various forms. I think you don't have a friend or anyone who's got it. So this is my take. I really think it's a mirage. We're going to go do one more email. This is one that I didn't get to last week. Here it is. Jacqueline in Santa Cruz. Food sensitivities test. Dear Dr. Don, I would appreciate your opinion on the Everly Well food sensitivities tests. One of my students' tests came back with a ridiculous amount of food sensitivities as abnormal, flagged ranging from the 20s to 77 to 100, 111 for mushrooms, which is her max. I'm pretty sure these are wonky test results and just promoting anxiety with unnecessary food restrictions. And this is a patient-purchased at-home finger prick tests. And the website says, this at-home test measures your body's immune response to 96 foods to help guide you on what types of food may be the best choice for an elimination diet. Okay, so true and yet so not true at the same time. Let's talk about any kind of antibody testing. What we're looking at here is IgG. In other words, have you gotten vaccinated against a food? What causes you to be vaccinated? A leaky gut and a high level of consumption. Do we leak a little bit all the time? Sure. That's why we have blood group antigen problems, because the A and the B blood groups are actually fairly common in plant lectins. So when we start eating, we become sensitized to these lectins and will attack a blood transfusion because it just so happens that human blood carries a similar molecule on its surface. So actually the whole ABO thing is a low-grade molecular mimicry that has drastic consequences if you take somebody else's blood and stick it into the wrong person's body. When we come to testing, however, one of the tricks with testing and one of the reasons it's so easy to game is this idea of thresholds. So if I'm selling a test that we want to be positive, if the test comes back normal, then it obviously isn't the cause of their problems. If the test comes back abnormal, well, you'll tell your friends about it. And maybe you'll go on that elimination diet and then test again in a couple of months. And yes, indeed, your antibody levels will have dropped because you will not have been boosting yourself. But it only tells you that you've got a leaky gut. So your student has a leaky gut. Your student needs to work on fixing her microbiome and supporting it. And I certainly will refer you to previous programs where we've talked at length about what you need to do to fix a leaky gut. And there's plenty of good information out there about how to support the human microbiome. And you can do it inexpensively with fermented foods and diets and simple things like oregano and garlic, which help discourage the growth of the dysbiotic bacteria. So what does this mean? Well, now you know. Let's see if we have time. I will say that sometimes on some of these websites, there's a very disingenuous link to another website that will be happy to sell you things that will help you with your food sensitivities. And so, you know, whenever you see that kind of thing, you should wonder if this is the Nigerian prince. Now we're going to shift focus to talk about clinical context. The two bits of advice I'm going to cover today are cholesterol and aspirin. One of the greatest cognitive errors doctors make
is applying double-blind placebo-controlled trials to the general population. The double-blind placebo-controlled trial tells you about the population that was studied. Many trials exclude certain groups, notably women, especially those of childbearing age, and people over a certain age, often age 70. Non-white people in general are underrepresented in these trials, and there are various reasons for this. But the big two are the selective pressure to get a statistically significant result, like I was talking about with the vaccine, and liability concerns. The thalidomide disaster still echoes across the ages when you think about liability and pregnant women. The first issue is more subtle. Papers that have negative results, i.e. X doesn't change the outcome, are rarely published. The researcher just wasted a year, or however long it took, plus the grant money. Not a good way to make a stellar career in science. Statistical significance is easier to get the more homogeneous your test group. You can also game the math by having a very big group, a thing called statistical power. So cognitive error number one, the homogeneous group study tells you about intervention X in the homogeneous group. A study in Taiwanese college students may or may not apply to Taiwanese women over the age of 50 or to African men over 70. Get it? These results are not generalizable, but we do it all the time. It's a cognitive error in medicine, and many of the recommendations, including the two we're about to talk about, are flawed because that was not taken into account. The second trick, the meta-analysis, or very large combined study, has a different issue. An intervention that works even a little bit will be statistically significant as an artifact of how we do the math. If you're a science geek and actually read the methods section of papers, which I recommend, by the way, don't stop at the abstract, skip to the method, see if it makes sense. I have some advice. Run screaming if you see a large study, say over 1,000 individuals, and the statistical method used is the student's t-test. The results will likely be statistically significant, but clinically meaningless. Cognitive error number two. Established by the data, drug X over 10 years reduces heart attacks by 25%. But what if the rate of heart attacks in the population was low? What if it was 1 out of 50 in the placebo group that got a heart attack over 10 years? Well, then you'd have to give 200 people the drug for 10 years to prevent one heart attack. That is a cognitive error. So the two things that I'm going to tell you, one of them, I think, super important, is this whole low-dose aspirin thing. I bet you didn't know this. I was taught that all diabetics should be on low-dose aspirin. Nope. You have to assess them for their cardiovascular risk. If they have good cholesterol, they have not had an event, they don't have a family history, they're non-smoker, they don't have hypertension, then you're probably going to do them more harm than good by initiating low-dose aspirin. And that is regardless of the age, which I find fascinating. So you have to do one of those risk scores. Now, if the diabetic's 70, you run into a problem because the latest data on primary prevention says if you're over 70 and you haven't had a heart attack, you're probably not going to benefit. In fact, the aspirin may cause more GI bleeding and stress your system, possibly kill you. And there isn't enough benefit, because if you get to be past 70 and you haven't had any heart disease, well, guess what? You probably aren't at increased risk for heart disease, so you're not going to zero out your risk to nothing with the aspirin, and the risk of the aspirin outweighs the benefit. Who should you use it in? Well, people who've had heart disease. Sounds reasonable. If they are still at high risk, they should be on aspirin. If they're diabetic and they have a high risk, they should be on aspirin. If you can see vascular disease in their body because you did an angiogram, they should be on aspirin. What about a person who's at high risk but has an increased bleeding risk for whatever reason? Well, maybe if you give them a proton pump inhibitor, like omeprazole and the aspirin, you can get away with it. But then you're going to be weighing the downside of the proton pump inhibitor, increased pneumonia, increased osteoporosis, and we're talking long-term stuff, and increased dementia and neuropathy. know, maybe it's worth it. The proton pump inhibitor is not without its downstream problems. And then you've got the bleeding, which isn't entirely mitigated. So exactly what are we doing here? Well, I'll tell you what we're doing. We're flailing around in the dark, trying to figure something out. What about this one? Cholesterol, right? Lower cholesterol, better. Wrong. All-cause mortality is what we should be looking at when we talk about using drugs to lower cholesterol. All-cause mortality. What do you die of? When do you die? Do you die earlier? And it turns out that all-cause mortality is lowest at an LDL cholesterol level of 140. Go look at your lab. That's dangerous. You're above 100. You should, you know, talk to your doctor. They put it in red on the lab form. This study collected over 100,000 Danes and examined the associations between LDL cholesterol and mortality for about 10 years. And what they found was that you died more if your cholesterol, your LDL cholesterol was under 70 or over 190. But if you were between 132 and 154, levels which in this country you would be treated with a statin because your doctor would freak out, guess what? You're better off not taking it for all-cause mortality. Why is that? Because statins especially are not harmless. They confer a risk. The benefit has to overcome the risk. And in this case, maybe we should rethink our policy. I hope you've enjoyed this program. I'll be back next week to answer your questions, and we'll take another walk on the wild side of modern medicine. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.